Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight, the drawing rooms of London become a stage where reputation itself is on trial. A missing packet of letters, a princess with too many enemies, and a journalist eager for scandal draw Poirot and Hastings into a tangle of secrets where even loyalty may betray. This is The Shadow of Scandal, written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, and inspired by the real affair of Princess Catherine Radziwill, whose forged letters and audacious claims once rocked European society. Yet the mystery you will hear tonight is entirely our own invention. Before we begin, tell me in the comments, where in the world are you listening from this time around? I spend time with each answer, often replying, and it's your presence that makes this community feel alive. Creating these tales, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and your support is what allows us to keep going. You can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive content, or leave a small tip if you wish. But know that simply by being here, listening, commenting, and sharing, you are already giving more than enough. Now, the chandeliers are lit, the letters wait, and scandal hovers at the door. Chapter 1. A Princess Calls. There are certain mornings in London that present themselves with such propriety that one feels it would be an impertinence to be untidy in thought or dress. On such a morning, I found Hercule Poirot already immaculate, seated at his breakfast table in our rooms at Whitehaven Mansions, the light from the window striking sparks from his silver egg spoon, as though the thing had a personality and wished to rival its master. "Regardez, Hastings," he murmured with the air of a conjurer revealing a dove. "The yoke is centered." "When the yoke is centered, the day begins in symmetry." "It's a pity everything cannot be so obliging," I said. "The newspaper says the cabinet cannot agree about coal." Poirot patted his napkin as one might soothe an excitable spaniel. "The cabinet, mon ami, is never centered." I had no chance to reply. The bell trilled, and a moment later, our small and formidable landlady ushered in a lady of distinction whose personality preceded her like a fanfare. She was tall, very dark, and very pale, with the sort of pallor that suggests both late hours and the deliberate cultivation of mystery. She was magnificently dressed, but the magnificence had known other days. Rubies glowed at her throat. They had perhaps glowed more wickedly once. "Monsieur Poirot," she said, and her voice contrived to make my name as she saw it, "the friend," sound pleasantly unimportant. "I am Princess Catherine Radziwill." "Poirot," corrected my friend mildly, rising and bowing over the hand she extended with the ease of a sovereign bestowing grace. "And my friend, Captain Hastings." She sank into the chair Poirot indicated, and I could not but observe the faintest breathlessness that arrived with her, whether the result of the stairs, a carriage dispute, or the secret pressure of history, I could not determine. "You are kind to receive me," she began. "I do not come at an hour when one calls, perhaps, but the matter presses." "Matters that press," said Poirot, "are often matters that have been too long adored." "Start, then, at the beginning, Madame la Princesse," she smiled, revealing beautiful teeth that were perhaps a trifle too eager. "The beginning? There are so many. In Petersburg they called me a radical. In Berlin, intrigant. In Paris, a princess. In London, well, London is indulgent, yet even London will not indulge a woman who is called a liar." "Who has called you that?" I asked, before Poirot's warning glance could marshal me to silence. "Everyone who wishes to borrow courage from a word," she said lightly, "but names are a poor currency. What is valuable is paper, papers, letters. That is why I have come." Poirot's eyes sharpened. "Letters?" "Yes. letters that were written to me many years ago by a man who was then the most powerful private citizen in the empire. You know the name, Sir Rupert Harborough. The name was not unknown to me. Harborough had been a colossus, diamond mines, railways, a financier whose shadow fell across continents. He was dead now. Even so, men lowered their voices when they spoke of him, as though money could still hear. "And you have these letters?" said Poirot. "I had them," she returned. "Yesterday morning they were in my escritoire. Last night after dinner I had a small party, nothing, how do you say, compromising. When I opened the drawer, they were gone." "Who was present?" asked Poirot. She raised delicate fingers, counting. "The Count Trevesi. He is Italian, charming, harmless. He plays the violin like an angel who has learned something in the other place. Mr. Alistair Kay, the journalist. His magazine prints the truth if it is fashionable, and otherwise the fashionable if it is not the truth. Mrs. Burbage, oh, you must know her. She is everywhere, like a good umbrella. And my secretary, Miss Vale."
"And the servants?"
"My butler, old Barton. He is stone about the ears and granite about the heart, a maid to bring coffee. No more."
Poirot made a small tent of his fingers. "And these letters, why are they important now?"
Princess Caterina's eyes met his directly.
"Because Mr. Kay has prepared an article, several, in fact, on the late Sir Rupert. He wishes to write of that period in South Africa, when fortunes were minted and souls perhaps pawned. He has heard rumours of the letters. He believes they will confirm certain, indiscretions. He is not wrong, but he is not right either. The letters are, how do you say, warm, but not inflaming. They reveal a man in haste, a man who desired me, yes, yes, I do not blush, I am past blushing, and who promised what men promise when desire runs ahead of prudence. If they are published, I am ruined. If they are destroyed, I am accused of inventing them. If they are forged..."
"Forged!" I exclaimed. She gave a small laugh of real feeling, the first I had heard from her. "Forged! Always the word for me. My enemies think I make paper as spiders make silk. That is why you must find the originals, Monsieur Poirot. Without them I have only my honour, and my honour has been in pawn often enough to be thought counterfeit."
There was a silence. Poirot's eyes travelled from her hands, nervous but under control, to the rubies at her throat, and finally to the line of her shoulders, which were very straight.
"You will show me the escritoire," he said at last.
"Of course. I have a carriage." He threw me a glance.
"Your hat, Hastings."
The princess's house was in Berkeley Square, a tall, narrow building whose windows had the patient stare of an aristocrat fallen upon adjustments. Inside, the carpets were splendid and tired, the furniture of great age and recent debt. We were admitted by Barton, who looked at us as though we were two unexpected items on a menu he had not personally approved.
"The library," said the princess, and swept us through to a long room where books rose soberly to a cornice of plaster acanthus, and a cold grate apologized for September's indecision. At one end, by a French window, stood a lacquered escritoire of oriental workmanship, its black surfaces polished to a jealous shine.
"I locked it yesterday morning," she said, producing a small key from her chain. "When I opened it after the guests had gone, see?" She inserted the key and turned it. The lid sprang back with a sigh, revealing an orderly array of pigeonholes, a blotter, and a secret drawer which could scarcely have been secret to anyone with an inch of romance. She touched a carved leaf. A narrow tray slid forward.
"It was here," she murmured. "A flat parcel of letters bound with green silk. It is not here."
Poirot bent, not to the tray, but to the keyhole. He sniffed delicately, like a hound of breeding.
"Oil," he said. "Very faint. Not machine oil. Lavender."
"Lavender?" I repeated blankly.
"Miss Vale," said the princess promptly. "She is particular."
But she could not have opened the desk.
"I keep the key always with me." Poirot pointed to the key.
It has been in other company, I think, than that of your chain. He indicated with a small gleam of triumph a lighter arc upon the blade. Where metal rubs often in one lock and suddenly in another, one sees it. Someone has taken a wax impression and prepared a key. Very good, very soft. Used it once, perhaps twice. That would explain the oil. A false key that is not oiled, he breaks. A false key that is oiled, he sings.
Then it is Miss Vale, I said.
Princess Katerina gave the faintest shrug. Miss Vale is loyal, to whom I do not always know. She is young and English and believes that truth is a person who can be introduced, but she would not rob me.
Barton? I suggested.
Barton believes theft to be a constitutional responsibility of the upper orders, said the princess dryly. He would die before presuming upon their privileges. Poirot had moved to the French windows. He examined the catch minutely, then drew back, eyes bright. Hastings, he said. Our thief is correct in his habits, but not romantic. He has come by the door, not the window.
Then one of the guests, I asked.
Or the servant of one, said Poirot.
Tell me, madam, during the evening, did any of your friends request a particular piece of music? A song, a telegram, a photograph? Anything that would send you upon an errand, even for 1 minute?
Her brow creased. Mr. K was importunate about a photograph taken at Grootshoor, Sir Rupert's house in Cape Town. He begged me to find it. It was not in the album, I thought. I went upstairs to my bedroom to see if it had been placed there among other souvenirs.
Et voilà,
murmured Poirot, and during those moments downstairs,
Trevisy played the violin, she said.
Mrs. Burbage cried. She always cries at Italian music. Miss Vale brought more coffee. Mr. K wrote notes upon an envelope, because he thinks that to write on envelopes makes him look like a journalist of genius.
Very good, said Poirot.
Now, the servants? Barton and the maid, Lucy. Lucy is from Kent. She believes that ladies with foreign titles live by sorcery and champagne. She would not dare to open my desk. She would expect it to bite. Poirot allowed himself a small smile. He peered again at the floor near the desk, then at the mantel, then, with an expression of mild distaste, at a priceless Sèvres vase which had been relegated to the service of a damson branch. At last he straightened. "Madam," he said gently, "you have been accustomed to storms. You carry a lightning rod in your spirit. But there is a small thing, a very small thing, which even the storm cannot avoid, the dust."
"The dust," she said, bewildered.
"Regard," said Poirot. "There is upon the tray of your secret drawer a faint smear. No, do not touch, where a finger that had recently handled something greasy, let us say the oiled key, rested to draw the letters out. The finger is slender, the nail narrow. It is not the finger of Barton, whose nail is like a small shovel. It might be of Miss Vale, or of Mr. K, who bites his nails, and therefore cannot leave so neat an oval. It might be the maid, if she were not terrified. And the scent of lavender belongs, perhaps, to more than one."
"Then you cannot tell?" she demanded, and for an instant the royal mask slipped, revealing a woman very near to despair.
"I can tell two things," said Poirot calmly. "First, that the theft was made while your guests were here, and not afterwards. Second, that the letters have not left the house." She started.
"Not left? But how? Why?"
"Because," said Poirot, and now his eyes gleamed with the pleasure he always takes in the little demonstration, "had they been carried beyond your door, the thief would have taken them in a form more convenient than a green silk parcel. There would be the mark of folding. There would be a roughness somewhere upon the silk. There is none. To carry them thus, c'est trop visible. Therefore he hides them first. And being either pressed by time or uncertain of the best place, he hides them near."
"Near?"
I asked, glancing at the books, the curtains, the chairs.
"Near," repeated Poirot serenely,
and crossed to the fireplace. He knelt, examined the brass fender, and then the rim of the cold grate. "Oui," he murmured. "Very near indeed." Before either of us could speak, the door opened, and Miss Vale entered. She was a slim girl with a capable mouth, and that clear English look which makes the rest of us feel shabby. She paused on seeing us, then came forward with commendable composure. "Your Highness," she said to the Princess, "Mr. K is here. He insists upon seeing you at once. He says his article goes to press tonight, and if he cannot have your comments—" "My comments?" repeated the Princess, and laughter flickered again, dangerously. "Very well. I shall give him comments enough to poison him. Show him to the drawing-room. Monsieur Poirot, you will come?" "If Madame permits," said Poirot. Miss Vale withdrew, and the Princess, with a quick breath, extended a hand to each of us in turn. "You will help me?" she said. "I can pay later. I can promise more. Now." Poirot bowed. "Madame la Princesse, I desire only that the truth should not be bullied by gossip, nor the past by a careless pen." We followed her into the corridor. The light was cooler there, and somewhere a clock in the house, not in sympathy with the scented yoke of the morning, struck the quarter with a peevish rattle. At the far end, where the drawing-room doors stood open, a man's voice rose, insistent and eager. "Your Highness," it was saying, "the public has a right—" Poirot paused, his head cocked, and his hand, small, very neat, touched my sleeve. "Hastings," he murmured, "before we speak to the journalist who thinks truth lives on an envelope, go back, I pray you, to the library. Outside the door there is a jardiniere of blue porcelain with a dragon. Lift the dragon by the nose." "Lift him? What?" I began. "Lift him by the nose," said Poirot patiently. "And if you find what I believe you will find, bring it at once. But, attendez, bring it with the jardiniere." I stared. "What on earth—" "The earth, precisely," said Poirot. "That is where we shall begin to dig. I confess I did not understand, but I have long since learned that to argue with Poirot at such moments is to be the last to the winning post." I turned back toward the library, the Princess sweeping on ahead to do battle with Mr. K, and as I entered I glanced, out of habit, at the French windows. They were as we had left them. The desk gleamed. The blue jardiniere, dragon and all, squatted by the door with the complacency of a beast that, if it could speak, would purr. Feeling a little foolish, I stooped and took the dragon by the nose. The lid lifted, and within, half buried in dry soil, was a flat parcel bound about with green silk. Chapter 2. Mr. K presses his claim. The drawing-room of Princess Radzivill was a place made for diplomacy. The chairs were gilt, the sofas upholstered in pale blue silk, and the air was faintly perfumed with lilies that had ceased to bloom several days ago. Against this setting, Mr. Alastair K looked almost indecently modern. He was a lean young man with hair brushed back until it shone like patent leather, and a fountain pen protruding from his breast pocket like a badge of office. He stood before the Princess with all the assurance of a man who believes himself the herald of truth. "Your Highness," he was saying as Poirot and I entered, "my article will appear with or without your cooperation. It would be far better for your reputation if I could print your own words alongside the evidence."
"The evidence?"
she repeated, in a tone that could have chilled brandy. "You speak as though you held it already." Kay's eyes flickered. "Not yet." "But I know the letters exist. If you will not show them to me, others will." At that moment I had returned, clutching the jardiniere as Poirot had instructed. The Princess shot me a glance of astonishment, but Poirot merely inclined his head and set the porcelain gently upon a side table. He did not lift the lid, only allowed one neat finger to rest upon the dragon's painted nose, as though commanding silence from a pet.
"Perhaps," said Poirot softly, "you are too confident, Monsieur K.
The evidence is sometimes nearer than you think, and yet further than you imagine." Kay gave a short laugh. "If that is a riddle, Monsieur Poirot, I prefer plain speech. The public has a right to know what manner of man built the fortunes that rule them still."
"Bah!"
The public Poirot's mustaches quivered. "The public is like a child. It demands sweets. But if you give too many, it is sick. You are not a physician, monsieur, merely a vendor at the fair."
The princess raised a jeweled hand.
"Enough!
If you wish to write, then write. But you shall have nothing from me." Kay's smile hardened. "Then I must seek my sources elsewhere." With a quick bow, half courteous, half insolent, he took his leave, his footsteps ringing decisively down the marble corridor. When he was gone, the princess turned to Poirot with sudden passion. "You see, he will hound me. He has scented scandal, and he will have it, whether it exists or not." Poirot looked at her gravely. "Then we must deprive him of the scent, madame." He tapped the jardiniere. "For the moment, the letters are safe. But who placed them there is still to be known." Her dark eyes widened. "You have found them. Already." Poirot lifted the lid. The green silk parcel lay half hidden in soil. The princess reached for it with a cry, but Poirot held up a hand.
"Patience.
To seize too soon is to risk much. Tell me, who among your guests had leisure to place them here? Not you, since you sought them upstairs. Not Mrs. Burbage, whose tears flow too freely for secrecy. Treversy, perhaps, between adagios, or Mr. K himself scribbling his notes, or your Miss Vale, the faithful secretary."
"Faithful," the princess gave a bitter laugh. "She is English, Mem Poirot. Their faith is to themselves." Poirot said nothing. He was examining the ribbon binding the letters. At last he replaced them carefully and closed the lid. "We will leave them here for the present," he declared. "A fish, Hastings, is caught not by striking when he bites, but by letting him think himself free. The thief will return, assured that his hiding place is unsuspected. Then we shall see." It was the following morning when Miss Vale herself came to Whitehaven Mansions. She was neat, brisk, and gave the impression of a schoolmistress addressing inattentive pupils. "I must speak plainly, Captain Hastings," she said, fixing me with clear blue eyes. "Her Highness is a woman of distinction, but also of imagination. She sees conspiracies where none exist. If letters have been mislaid, they will be found. But to accuse her friends and servants, well, it is unworthy." Poirot listened with folded hands. "Mademoiselle, you are devoted to the princess?" "I am employed by her."
"Ah, but employment without devotion is like tea without sugar. Bitter." Miss Vale's expression did not soften. "I respect her. But I cannot prevent her from inventing dramas to amuse herself. As for Mr. K, he is vulgar, but he may do her a service. Perhaps a little truth would not harm her reputation so much as silence." Poirot's eyes narrowed.
"And what truth would that be?"
Miss Vale hesitated. "She has lived freely. Men have admired her. She has not always refused their admiration. Why should we pretend otherwise?" At that, Poirot rose, bowing her to the door with exquisite courtesy. Only when she had gone did he turn to me. "There, Hastings, you have the English virtue, candor, that wounds more cruelly than any continental intrigue. Mademoiselle Vale may speak the truth, but she does not speak all the truth. One must ask, for whom does she work? For herself? For the princess? Or for Mr. K?"
"Do you think she stole the letters?" I asked.
Poirot shrugged. "It is possible.
But remember the dust upon the tray, the slender finger. It might be hers, yes. Yet Mr. K, too, has slender hands, though bitten at the nails. The matter is not yet clear."
That evening we returned to Berkeley Square. The princess received us in a mood of high nervousness. "Barton has reported," she said, "that Mr. K attempted to bribe him this afternoon.
He offered him £20 to search my desk. The insolence! Poirot raised his brows.
And Barton?
Barton told him that Her Highness's property is not to be touched by hired scribblers. Then he showed him the door.
Très bien, said Poirot. Barton is granite, as you said, yet £20 is a sum that might tempt another.
At that moment a note was delivered by a boy in uniform. The princess tore it open, read, and passed it to Poirot with a trembling hand. It was from Alistair Kay. If the Princess Radzivill will not assist me, others will. I have already secured information from a source very close to her person. Tonight the truth will be written. The princess collapsed upon the sofa, one jeweled hand pressed to her forehead.
Do you see? Betrayal. Who else can it be but Vale? She is the only one close to my person. Oh, I am undone.
Poirot did not attempt to comfort her. Instead, he stood very still, eyes half closed, as though arranging small counters upon an invisible board. At last he spoke.
Hastings, tomorrow we shall dine again at the princess's house. I wish all the same guests to be invited. And during that dinner the thief shall betray himself, for I have seen already the little clue, very little, that points the way. One more detail is needed, and then, the whole affair will stand revealed.
I stared at him. But Poirot, what clue? He smiled, touching his moustache.
Mon ami, do you not recall?
When the princess sought the photograph, she left the room. When she returned, the letters were gone. It is in that interval that the crime occurred. Ask yourself, who profited by her absence? Who moved? Who did not move?
Observe, Hastings. Observe!
He tapped the side of his head. The little grey cells have almost completed their labour. Tomorrow evening they will deliver to us not scandal, not gossip, but the truth. And with that tantalising promise, Poirot took his leave of the princess, leaving her still pale with agitation and me burning with curiosity that, as usual, he refused to satisfy.
Chapter 3. The Trap is Laid.
I have often observed that when Hercule Poirot announces a revelation, tomorrow, the morrow arrives with indecent slowness. It was with relief that I found myself, that very next evening, once more amid the pale blue salons of Princess Radzivill, where lilies drooped with the air of debutantes who have danced past midnight and mean to be admired for the effort. The guests were the same. Mrs. Burbage had the grateful sheen of one who has been asked out twice in a week and is determined to mention it. Count Trevesi, thin and exquisitely melancholy, carried his violin case like a confidant who has never betrayed a secret. Mr. Alistair Kay stood at the window, examining the street with proprietary interest, a carnation in his buttonhole that looked as though it did public relations. Miss Vale, composed as a schoolroom clock, stood at the princess's elbow, and made the arrangement of menus appear a moral victory. Barton, the granite butler, moved with sacerdotal gravity.
Poirot, modestly effaced behind a low armchair, regarded them all with a benignity that would have reassured sinners and alarmed saints.
Dinner was announced. We went in. The princess had arranged matters, on Poirot's advice, I am sure, so that the order of seats matched the previous evening's, Mrs. Burbage to her right, Kay to her left, myself opposite, Trevesi near the sideboard, Poirot between Miss Vale and the salt. The meal proceeded with the stately cheerfulness English kitchens bestow when asked to imitate France. Conversation, like the sauce, achieved consistency.
"It is a curious thing," said Mrs. Burbage, "how the truth, when written, acquires an unpleasant tone.
Spoken, it is gossip. Printed, it is cruelty." Kay smiled.
"The historian is often abused for using ink.
Would you prefer your history in tears?" Miss Vale set down her glass. "Truth is neither tears nor ink. It is a ledger. One should balance it."
"Ah."
Trevesi sighed.
spreading delicate hands. "You English, you balance everything. Even your passions are brought to table with the bills." The princess lifted her chin. "Some of us have paid bills for years, Count. Others have sent them to the wrong address." Poirot, who had been following the exchange with eyelids at half-mast, roused himself to admire the bread. Only I, who know him, observed the minute adjustments he made, how his chair was set at an angle commanding both door and mantel, how his napkin was folded not once but twice, a ritual whose significance I have never wholly grasped, but which portends in Poirot a design. With the roast, Kay grew practical. "Your Highness," he said in his most persuasive newsroom voice, "you hold in your possession documents of considerable historical interest. You will not, I think, destroy them. Will you not at least allow a responsible writer to consult them?" "I pledge discretion." The princess regarded him with a look I should not have liked to deserve. "Monsieur, your discretion is to history what a veil is to a dancer. It exists to be removed." Trevisy touched his case. "Music, then?" he pleaded. "If we must quarrel, let it be in a minor key." "After dinner," said the princess. "Barton, coffee in the library, just as last night." Poirot's eyebrows twitched. "Precisely as last night, madame?" "Precisely." We rose. In the corridor, the little procession formed, the princess and Mrs. Burbage in the van, Poirot with Miss Vale, Kay a step behind them, I, and at the rear, Trevesi with his violin. Barton preceded us to open the library door. The air within was delicately perfumed, lavender, or so my country knows supposed, and the lacquered escritoire, that small stage of our drama, gleamed in its corner by the French window. The blue porcelain jardiniere squatted by the door with superb indifference. I felt my heart give a foolish little leap. Within that calm dragon's belly, fate lay coiled in green silk. We gathered as before. Trevesi, invited with a nod, rosined his bow and drew the first notes of a canzonetta from his instrument. Soft, persuasive, the musical equivalent of a hand upon the pulse. Mrs. Burbage produced a handkerchief in readiness. The princess, after one circuit of the room like a general taking measure of positions, paused at the mantel and warmed her fingers at a fire that was not lit. Kay had stationed himself by a small table and was engraving a cheap envelope with hieroglyphs. Miss Vale busied herself at the tray. Barton, having set down the coffee, withdrew to the door and froze into butlery. It was, in short, a reconstruction. Presently the princess exclaimed with well-bred surprise, "How thoughtless of me! I promised to show you, Captain Hastings, the photograph of Groot Schuur, the one Sir Rupert signed. It is upstairs, alas, among a chaos of albums." "Forgive me a moment." She moved towards the door. I confess an impulse to accompany her, but Poirot's glance, sharp as a pin, rebuked me. The princess passed out. We all, in that curiously theatrical way one does when one knows one is being watched, did exactly as we had been doing. Trevesi played. Mrs. Burbage dabbed. Kay scribbled. Miss Vale lifted the coffee pot and poured. Then, with that unobtrusive competence which is her trade, she carried a cup to me and another to Poirot, and finally one to Kay. "Thank you," said Kay. "No sugar." "Of course," said Miss Vale, without looking, and placed two lumps in his cup. He made a face, laughed, and drank it anyway. She moved on. Poirot's gaze travelled gently. It alighted on Trevesi's bow hand, elegant, upon Mrs. Burbage's damp lashes, abundant, upon Kay's ink-stained fingers, nervous, and finally upon Miss Vale's gloves. They were grey kid, very correct, very clean, save for the slightest bloom of dullness upon the right forefinger, as though she had pressed it to a surface not quite polite. 10 minutes passed. The princess returned, empty-handed and vexed. "It is not there," she declared. "I must have misremembered." "It is of no consequence," said Poirot soothingly. "We have consoled ourselves with the music, n'est-ce pas?"
"Music that has made me a fool," sobbed Mrs. Burbage on cue. "Count, you are a wicked man."
Trevesi bowed. "Barton," said the princess, recovering, "the window is closed. Open it an inch. The lilies are too... She made a gesture, and the lilies drooped in agreement. Barton obeyed. A cool thread of night stole in. Somewhere beyond the square, a cab turned and was lost. "Now," said Poirot, in a tone that made us all, even Kay, look at him. "If Madame permits a trifle, a very little demonstration for which I beg your indulgence."
He stepped to the jardiniere, placed two fingers lightly upon the dragon's nose, and lifted the lid.
The green silk parcel lay as we had left it. Even Kay's assurance deserted him. He stared. Miss Vale did not move, but I saw her throat rise and fall once.
"Regard," murmured Poirot. He did not touch the parcel. "It has lain here one day and a night.
Dust, my friends, is a faithful witness. On the silk there is, at the corner, a faint smear, visible if one stoops, of the sort one acquires by the handling of keys that are oiled with lavender. That we observed yesterday. Today there is, how shall I say, another testimony." He produced a small square of white linen, and with a magician's air, laid it gently upon the silk, then lifted it again. Across the linen there ran a ghostly band, pale and regular, as though chalk had kissed it.
"Powder?" ventured Kay.
"Not powder, monsieur. Pollen. The lilies, you comprehend, have done us the honour to die extravagantly. Their pollen falls upon the air, upon the table, upon the silk. If, since Madame left us for her photograph, anyone had lifted this parcel, the pattern upon the linen would be broken where fingers pressed. It is unbroken. Therefore, during that interval, the parcel was not touched."
Then no one took them last night," cried the princess.
"It was before."
"It was after?"
"Patience." Poirot's eyes shone. "Another moment. Barton, be so good as to fetch, from the small table by the French window, the glass paperweight in the form of a bee." Barton went, brought it, solemn as a verger carrying the elements. Poirot glanced at the base, frowned, and smiled. "This, you perceive, is dusted. By whom? Not Barton, whose dusting is a sacrament. He never omits the underside. But someone has, how to say, borrowed the bee and returned it, wiping that which he disturbed."
He turned suddenly sharp.
"Monsieur Kay, yesterday evening you wrote upon an envelope. Do you carry it still?"
Kay flushed, produced the object. Poirot took it delicately.
"Here is a circle," he observed, faintly impressed, as by the weight of glass set upon paper to prevent its flight. "And upon the rim a trace of... what? Soil. Very fine. The jardiniere's soil, which is peculiar. A mixture with grit. Monsieur Kay, yesterday, when Madame left us, you placed your envelope upon this table, set the bee upon it, and, since your curiosity as a bartender who never closes, lifted the lid of the jardiniere." Kay's lips tightened.
"And if I did?"
"I did not take the letters."
"Ah, but you advertised a hiding place," said Poirot. "You are indiscreet, not a thief."
Kay laughed shortly. "Your distinction will not comfort me in print." He looked at the princess. "I admit it. I looked. That is all."
"Not all," said Poirot gently. "Someone observed you. Someone who needed only to know where to seek.
Later, after we were gone, our thief returned. But this time, the thief did not remove the parcel. He had already removed the letters."
The princess uttered a small cry. "But they are here."
"They are not," said Poirot. And indeed, when he at last lifted the green silk and undid the ribbon with those dainty, precise fingers of his, he revealed not a packet of papers, but a sheaf of blank leaves, cut to size and weighted to the proper feel.
I confess I swore.
Mrs. Burbage, with gratifying consistency, burst into tears.
Kay stared, fascinated. Trevessi dropped his bow with a little clatter that was almost theatrical. Miss Vale's gloved hand, resting upon the back of a chair, did not move at all.
"Savoy fool that I am," I cried. "We brought the thing back here and never looked."
"Exactly," said Poirot placidly. "The thief counted upon our delicacy. We are scrupulous, Hastings. We do not rummage in a lady's parcel. It is a weakness of honour. He or she exchanged the contents yesterday in the first interval when Madame went upstairs," Kay rallied. "Then your pollen test proves nothing."
"It proves everything," returned Poirot with sudden heat. "It proves that tonight, when the opportunity was repeated, the thief did not touch the decoy. Why? Because the thief knew there was nothing to recover. She was content to let us admire our own prudence."
The princess pressed a hand to her lips. "Who? Name them."
Poirot's gaze moved very slowly from face to face. He lingered upon Trevessi's elegant hands, too clean, upon Mrs. Burbage's pink-rimmed eyes, too ingenuous, upon Kay's bitten nails, too candid in their way. It came to rest upon Miss Vale's glove. That immaculate kid had acquired within the last minute when she had steadied the chair a faint smear of dullness at the forefinger, as though the bloom upon porcelain had kissed it. And when she removed the glove at Poirot's infinitesimal inclination of the head, I saw upon her bare skin a thin crescent of earth beneath the nail. Fine, gritty, like the soil of the jardiniere. Miss Vale met Poirot's eyes without flinching.
"If you mean to accuse me, Monsieur Poirot, pray be precise. I detest ambiguity."
"Ambiguity is not in my line," he said almost kindly. "I do not accuse you of theft."
She colored, then paled, then smiled, a small tired smile that sat oddly upon her capable mouth.
"No."
"Then of what?"
"Of loyalty," said Poirot. "Loyalty wrongly placed."
"You have shielded someone. You have carried messages, perhaps even copies. You have believed that truth, your ledger, must be balanced at whatever cost. But the hand that stole last night was not yours."
The princess gave a gasp. "If not Vale, then who?"
Poirot turned to the door.
"Barton," he said softly.
The butler started. "Sir?"
"Inform the count," said Poirot with an old-fashioned bow to Trevessi, "that the piece he played after dinner yesterday was not entirely successful."
Trevessi's eyes widened, then narrowed. His fingers tightened upon the violin case.
"You suggest," he murmured, silk over steel, "that I stole a woman's letters."
"For what? For money? For art?"
"For both," said Poirot, "but not for yourself."
His gaze shifted past Trevessi to the little table and the envelope weighted by the glass B, then to Kay, then, very slowly, back to the princess.
"Madame," he said, in a tone I had rarely heard from him, gentle and grave, "it is time we invited into the room the only person who has not yet entered and who has directed our steps from the first, the dead."
The princess swayed. Her hand went out. Miss Vale caught it.
"Sir Rupert," she whispered.
"Sir Rupert," said Poirot, "and, if I am not mistaken, his heir."
There was a silence so complete that I heard, distinctly, the fall of lily pollen upon the cloth.
"Tomorrow," said Poirot, straightening, "we shall pay a visit to a solicitor and to a bank. Tonight, I ask only this, that the parcel remain untouched, and that no one, not even loyalty, make a single move."
He closed the jardiniere with a firm little clap, like a judge dismissing a case until the morning, and the dragon, inscrutable as China, took our secret into its painted belly once more.
Chapter 4. Ledgers and Loyalties. The morning after our curious séance with the dragon, Poirot was uncharacteristically brisk.
He breakfasted upon a single slice of toast for symmetry, consulted his little notebook, and declared that the truth, being a respectable Englishwoman, would most readily be found at her solicitors and her bank. We called first in Lincoln's Inn upon Mr. Chalmers of Chalmers and Yeo, a dry gentleman who looked as though he had been pressed between the pages of a deed at the age of 30 and had never quite recovered his moisture. He received us with that grave urbanity which solicitors wear as a robe.
"Monsieur Poirot, Captain Hastings, an honour," he murmured, indicating chairs that creaked with probity. "You inquire, I gather, concerning the late Sir Rupert Harborough."
"The living also concerns us," said Poirot delicately. "The heir." Mr. Chalmers folded his hands.
"Mr. Edwin Harborough, a correct young man, he possesses many of his revered uncle's virtues. Economy, caution, a dislike of publicity."
"And letters?" asked Poirot mildly. "His dislike extends to letters?" The solicitor's eyelids did not flicker. "I am, of course, unable to discuss private correspondence." Poirot bowed. "But you could perhaps enlighten us as to a legal curiosity. Suppose a lady possessed of certain letters, imprudent perhaps, but genuine. Suppose also that among them there is a note, a promise for a sum of money, not formally stamped, written by Sir Rupert's hand during a period of, how shall we say, sentiment. Is such a thing a claim against the estate?" Mr. Chalmers looked for the first time almost interested. "If the handwriting were established and certain formalities observed, a court might, I do not say would, regard it as a binding obligation. But in practice, Captain Hastings, such papers rarely see a court. They are—" He paused, searching for a word, and finding, being a solicitor, three: compromised, composed, or suppressed.
"Just so," said Poirot.
"And if one wished to ensure suppression, one might employ a person not obviously connected with the estate. A charming violinist, for example, who has lately enjoyed mysterious solvency."
"Really, Monsieur Poirot," said Mr. Chalmers, startled into humanity,
"you do not expect me to—"
"Non, non, I expect nothing." I observe Poirot rose, all politeness.
"One more thing only, Mr. Chalmers. Yesterday afternoon, did Mr. Edwin honor you with a visit?" There was the briefest of hesitations.
"He did."
"And afterwards," murmured Poirot, "the bank?" Mr. Chalmers's silence admitted everything a gentleman could admit. We took our leave.
"Eh bien, Hastings," said Poirot as we descended the steps, "the air is fresher already. Our Mr. Edwin has sniffed the jasmine. He fears that the past will climb his wall."
"At least," I observed, "we know now why the letters are coveted."
"A promissory note."
Poirot waggled a finger. "We suspect, not know. Remember, Chalmers spoke hypothetically. But there is another scent, the journalist. He desires scandal. The heir desires silence. Between them stands a lady who is tired of being called a liar. Voilà la comédie." The bank, Halberd and Company in Lombard Street, was a fortress with a polite voice. Poirot did not demand. He insinuated. He did not reveal. He hinted. Presently we were in a small, very private room with a deputy manager, whose manner suggested that he understood everything and approved nothing. "To be plain," he said at last, "Mr. Edwin Harborough has secured a substantial advance upon securities lodged here. The purpose was expressed as discretionary arrangements. No, I cannot tell you further." He inclined his head, a man who has just confessed to original sin and expects to be thanked for the entertainment.
"Discretion," repeated Poirot thoughtfully as we emerged. "An ugly word, Hastings, when it is written in a ledger. It walks abroad with arrangements, which is uglier."
We lunched in Soho. Poirot toyed with a cutlet and arranged the salt in a little pyramid, his eyes far away. "In the evening," he said at last, "we shall return to Berkeley Square. This time, I think, we shall speak less of lilies and more of loyalties. The princess received us in a gown that had been magnificent a decade earlier, and which she wore like a challenge to time. Miss Vale hovered near, self-contained. Barton glided a granite swan.
"News?" demanded the princess before we were seated.
"Only that the world goes on as before," replied Poirot soothingly. "Solicitors speak little, banks less, journalists too much. Madame, the letters, may I see one?"
She hesitated, then laughed shortly. "You expect me to produce them from my sleeve?"
"Alas, I am not the magician you suppose, Monsieur Poirot."
"You misunderstand me," said Poirot. "I do not ask for the originals which are gone. I ask for a copy."
"A copy?" she repeated.
"Princess," said Miss Vale quietly, "Monsieur Poirot is right." She crossed to a small bureau, unlocked a drawer, and brought out a single sheet. "I made this when Her Highness first spoke of the matter to me weeks ago."
I foresaw complications.
The princess stared.
"Vale!"
"I am your secretary," said Miss Vale, very pale. "It is my business to anticipate." Poirot took the sheet as though it were a sick child. His eyes travelled delicately over the lines. A short note in a rapid, assured hand. "My dear Caterina, you shall have the 30,000 when I return to town. The matter is arranged. Burn this. Such promises are unwise in ink." Hercule Poirot exhaled softly.
"C'était inevitable," he murmured. "Hastings, you see."
"Not a love letter, a ledger letter. 30,000 is not sentiment, it is arithmetic." The princess, who had recovered her wits with admirable speed, said coldly, "You keep much from me, Vale."
"I kept this to protect you," Miss Vale returned. "If the originals were lost, you would still possess proof that you had not invented them. If they were found, we could compare handwriting."
"Eh bien," said Poirot briskly, "we will do so." He rang.
"Barton, be so good as to request Count Trevesi to honour us. He is, I think, in the neighbourhood."
Barton's severe face did not alter.
"The Count left a card an hour ago, sir. He said he would return at 7.
"And the card?" asked Poirot.
Barton produced it. Poirot examined the pasteboard, flipped it, and smiled. On the reverse, lightly pencilled, was an address in Mayfair.
"Not the Count's handwriting," he observed, "and yet written for him. Barton, when the Count last visited, did he receive any other visitor while he was here?"
"Only a boy with a note, sir."
The Count went out immediately after reading it. Poirot nodded.
"So the strings are pulled." He turned to Miss Vale.
"Mademoiselle, when Mr. K bribed Barton, a clumsy business, did you communicate with anyone?"
Miss Vale coloured faintly.
"I wrote to Mr. Edwin Harborough's secretary. It seemed to me right that the family should be warned. I did not..." She hesitated. "I did not tell her about the letters, only that Mr. K was importunate and might write unkindly."
"Loyalty," said Poirot, very gentle. "To the name, not the truth."
She stared straight before her. "Sir Rupert did much harm. He also endowed hospitals. The living should not always pay for the dead."
"And yet," said Poirot, "the dead often collect."
There was a stir at the door. Count Trevesi entered with the unhurried grace of a man accustomed to being forgiven. He bowed to the princess, smiled at Miss Vale, and contrived to bestow upon Poirot an expression of courteous pity.
"You sent for me, madame?"
"I did," said the princess flatly. "Monsieur Poirot has something to say."
"Alas, too much," murmured Poirot. He held out the copy. "You have seen the original of this, Count?"
Trevesi's eyelids flickered.
"My letters of finance are not my music."
"Your music," said Poirot pleasantly, "is paid for. Yesterday after dinner, you played with feeling and left with a purse the heavier. This morning you visited a house in Mayfair at the invitation of a secretary who serves Mr. Edwin Harborough. There you received instructions. No, to continue your services. To exchange, when possible,
Madame's parcel against a decoy, to pass the originals to an intermediary who would see them destroyed.
Trevessi spread elegant hands. You paint a picture, Monsieur Poirot. It is very pretty.
Not pretty, said Poirot, but true.
He crossed to the lacquered escritoire, opened a drawer, and took out a small ebony baton.
You left this, Count, under the skirting near the window last night when you stooped too low for the music to examine the jardiniere. It bears a smear of soil with grit, our special mixture. Your tailor would not approve.
There was a little silence. Trevesi's smile did not alter, but something withdrew from his eyes.
And if I say yes? He asked softly.
If I admit, only to amuse you, that I carried letters for a lady who was once loved by a great man and now is persecuted by a small one.
What then?
Then, said Poirot, I say you did not carry them far. You are too cautious to keep such bargaining chips upon your person, and the house in Mayfair is too obvious. You placed them instead in the safest of all places, the bank, not your bank. The bank of Mr. Edwin Harborough. He will pay you, oh, something for the service, and will then ensure that the papers are composed or suppressed, as Mr. Chalmers would put it.
Trevesi's gaze slid almost involuntarily to Miss Vale. It was the smallest of movements, but Poirot pounced upon it with the avidity of a cat.
Merci, he said softly. I desired only to know for whom you played.
I played for money, returned Trevesi, suddenly weary. It is a vulgar accompaniment, but constant.
And you, Mademoiselle Vale, said Poirot, not unkindly, played for the ledger. You wrote to the heir's secretary. You believed you did right. You did not steal. You enabled. There is a difference, but not always for the victim.
The princess rose, very still.
So I am to be robbed between a journalist and a gentleman.
Neither gentleman nor journalist, said Poirot briskly. Between cowardice and haste. Monsieur K wants a sensation. Mr. Edwin wants peace. Neither wants justice.
What do you want, Monsieur Poirot? Demanded Trevesi quietly.
Order, said Poirot simply. That the truth be placed exactly where it belongs. No higher, no lower.
He turned to the princess.
Madame, will you accompany me to Halbert and Company in the morning? You will bring with you two things, Miss Vale's copy, and, if you please, one small trinket you own whose provenance is indisputable and whose value is high. We shall pay a visit to a private room, and we shall ask that a certain clerk, whose hands still smell of violet ink, produce a packet lodged here today under a name that is not the Count's. We shall then, he bowed slightly, discover whether the packet contains that which it should not. If it does, we shall place beside it the copy, we shall ask for a receipt, and we shall invite the deputy manager to choose between his discretionary arrangements and the law.
Trevesi laughed, a small fatalistic sound.
And if the packet is already ash?
Alors, said Poirot cheerfully, we shall make our drama upon the copy.
With Mr. Chalmers' help, we will invite Mr. Edwin to reflect upon the appearance, merely the appearance, of suppressing evidence of a debt acknowledged by his uncle's own hand. A little scandal in the city, a little talk at the club. Eh bien, 30,000 becomes a cheap price for silence.
The princess's eyes blazed.
You would bargain?
I would balance, said Poirot with a glance at Miss Vale that was not without kindness.
A ledger, mademoiselle, must be just. The princess is owed either money or honour. Tonight we cannot restore the one. Tomorrow we shall exact the other.
He took up his hat.
One last thing, madame.
Until morning, no letters, no visitors, no count. Barton, if anyone calls for her highness, you will say she is entertaining her solicitor and her temper.
Very good, sir, said Barton, in a tone that suggested that both were formidable.
Trevesi stood aside to let us pass. As I followed Poirot into the corridor, the violinist spoke, very low.
Monsieur Poirot, if I had not done it, another would.
The world is conducted in the key of convenience.
Poirot paused and looked back at him, his green eyes unexpectedly grave.
Change the key, monsieur.
Even an old melody sounds new when it is played where it ought.
Outside, the evening had already drawn its veil over Berkeley Square.
Poirot took my arm. You see, Hastings? We approach the end. Tomorrow, we shall pluck the string that runs from a dead man's desk to a living man's bank, and we shall hear which hearts it has tied.
And if it snaps? I asked.
Then, said Poirot with satisfaction, we shall knot it again in public.
Chapter 5. The Ledger is Closed. The morning was brisk with the kind of clarity London wears only after a night of rain. Poirot, immaculate as ever, declared that such weather was the atmosphere of justice and marched me toward Lombard Street as though the very paving stones would applaud his step. The princess accompanied us, dark eyes smouldering, Miss Vale in tow like a conscience that would not be left behind. At Halberd and Company, we were ushered once more into the private room, the deputy manager grave as a funeral. At Poirot's request, a certain packet was produced from the strongroom. It was flat, bound in green silk. My heart beat unreasonably fast. Poirot took it, weighed it delicately, and untied the ribbon. Inside lay the letters, the true letters this time, inked in Sir Rupert's bold, rapid hand. Among them was the note Miss Vale had copied, promising £30,000. The princess gave a cry, half triumph, half anguish.
"You see," she said. "You were right."
Poirot inclined his head.
"Yes, madame.
But the question is, what to do with them?" The deputy manager shifted uneasily. "These were deposited yesterday in the name of Mr. Edwin Harborough. I trust, Monsieur Poirot, you are not suggesting—"
"I suggest nothing," said Poirot crisply. "I demonstrate.
Hastings, observe the silk. It is frayed where it has been retied in haste. The ribbon bears the faintest trace of violet ink, such as your clerks use. These are indeed the princess's letters, stolen from her escritoire and lodged here under a false hand to ensure they could be destroyed quietly once the matter was settled. Eh bien, we shall not permit that destruction."
The princess turned to the manager, her chin high. "You would have burned them, admit it."
The man did not reply. Silence was confession enough.
Poirot replaced the letters in their packet and laid Miss Vale's copy beside them. "Here is my proposal," he said. "We place in your vault both the originals and the copy. We require a receipt, signed and witnessed, acknowledging that such documents exist, that they are deposited in the joint custody of the Princess Radzivill and Mr. Edwin Harborough, and that they shall not be removed save by consent of both parties.
Ainsi, no suppression, no scandal, only balance." The deputy manager hesitated, but Poirot's gaze was a net. Slowly, with the reluctance of a man dragged by honour, he nodded. "Very well. I shall prepare the form."
The princess swayed, then steadied herself with regal pride.
"So they cannot deny me now?"
"They cannot," said Poirot gently, "but you must also not abuse the proof."
"You are vindicated, that is enough."
Miss Vale's eyes filled with tears. "I thought only to protect you, madam. I did not know the Count would."
"You thought," said Poirot, "but you did not think far enough. Loyalty without judgment is like a violin without strings. It makes no music." At that moment the door opened. Edwin Harborough himself entered, summoned, no doubt, by urgent telegram. He was a tall, sandy young man, correct to the point of pallor, his moustache trained to resemble an elder statesman's, though he had barely 30 years.
"What is the meaning of this?" he demanded.
"My solicitor told me—" Poirot bowed.
Monsieur, it means that your uncle wrote imprudent letters, and that those letters now rest here in safety, beyond the reach of suppression or sensation. You may thank your solicitor's discretion and your bank's elasticity. But you must also thank this lady's perseverance. Without it, the world would have believed she invented what was, in truth, all too genuine.
Edwin coloured, then stiffened. If there is to be a claim...
No claim, said the princess swiftly. I do not want your money. I want only the world to cease calling me a liar.
Her voice, proud and trembling, echoed in the little room. Even Edwin faltered. If that is all...
It is all, said Poirot firmly. The ledger is balanced. You keep your estate unsullied. Madame keeps her honour. The dead keep their silence.
That evening, back at Whitehaven Mansions, we sat by the fire. Poirot was preening his moustaches with particular satisfaction.
You see, Hastings, he said, the affair was not of love, nor of politics, nor even of crime. It was of reputation. Princess Radzivill has lived by her reputation, sometimes tarnished, sometimes bright. To be called a forger was, to her, worse than to be called a thief. She has her vindication. She will sleep tonight.
And the Count? I asked.
Ah, he will vanish to Vienna or Rome, or perhaps Buenos Aires. Such men always do. He will find another patron, another song. As for Mr. K, he has material for an article, but nothing printable. He will be furious, and then he will find another scandal. Journalists, mon ami, are like the wind in March, cold, noisy, and passing.
And Miss Vale?
Poirot's expression softened. She will remain. She is capable, and the princess, for all her anger, will not dismiss her. Forgiveness, Hastings, is also a kind of loyalty.
I poked the fire.
And Edwin Harborough?
Poirot shrugged.
He will keep his fortune.
But he will also keep a memory that once, for the price of £30,000, his name trembled upon the brink of scandal. It may teach him humility. But, his eyes twinkled, I do not guarantee.
We were silent a moment. Then Poirot sighed with the contentment of a man who has restored symmetry to the world.
My friend, he said, do you recall at the beginning the egg with the yolk centered? It was an omen. Today, the yolk is centered again. That is all I ask. From eggs, from banks, from reputations, that they should be centered.
I laughed, though with a touch of exasperation. One day, Poirot, you will drive me mad with your eggs and your ledgers.
Better, Hastings, he returned with immense satisfaction, to be mad with symmetry than sane with chaos.
And so the affair of Princess Radzivill was closed, not with scandal, nor with payment, but with that quiet balance Poirot prized above all.
And so concludes The Shadow of Scandal, a tale where letters proved heavier than jewels, and where reputation itself was the prize most fiercely guarded. This story was written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, taking its inspiration from the true affair of Princess Catherine Radziwill, yet entirely original in its telling. If you've listened until now, then you are the reason these stories continue. Thank you for being part of this growing community. Your encouragement, your reflections, and your thoughtful comments make sharing these mysteries such a joy. I take time with each one, and I try to reply whenever I can. If you'd like to go further, you can join our membership or leave a small tip, but know that simply by listening and sharing, you are already keeping Nocturnal Tales alive. Until our next mystery, good night.